It's Mark Yeagy here, wealth architect and lifestyle investor. Let's take your life to the next level. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast. Hey, everybody, it's Mark Yeagy. Welcome to another episode of the Wealth Architect Podcast. Glad you're here today. And today we are with Jonathan Blau. He's the founder and chief executive officer of Fusion Family Wealth. It's a Long Island-based fee-only registered investment advisory firm that oversees approximately $1.1 billion in assets under advisement and management. For more than two decades, Jonathan has been a trusted advisor to trusted advisors with deep experience working with accounting and law firms on a wide array of financial services capabilities. His approach focuses predominantly on conditioning investors to learn to ignore current events, something I preach all the time. Always act on your plan, something else I preach all the time, and never react to the markets and media. Welcome, Jonathan Blau. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Mark, for having me join you on the podcast today. I'm looking forward to hopefully a lively discussion.
Let's do it. I love to talk about all things money. And you are in you're in the money business, right? You're in the investment advisory business, and you help people with their money. So what are like the basic things that people should just know? And maybe you could tell us how you got into the business to start, actually.
Of course. I'm gonna say from the perspective of the rest of the world looking in, I'm in the money business. But really, what I'm really in the business of is the human nature business. And we'll talk about that. So I started my career as an accountant with a firm that's no longer around, unfortunately, called Arthur Anderson, when there were six big accounting firms. And I was in the family wealth.
Four now, big three, four. What is it?
Yeah, now they call it the final four. It was the big six. Now it's the final four. So I spent about 4 years there after I pursued a master of science in tax, MBA in accounting. So I got my technical skills lined up, and I always wanted to get that experience to use it as a starting point to come into the wealth management business equipped with technical knowledge as opposed to just being a salesperson. And so that's kind of what I pursued. When I left Arthur Anderson, my first real stint in this business after having been an intern at Lehman Brothers in the summers of 88 and 87, I joined a firm called Sanford C. Bernstein when I left Arthur Anderson. And they were the largest independent wealth management firm in the country.
All right, so hang on a second. Let me stop you there. Sandy Bernstein still around?
He's not. He passed away in around 2000.
How about the firm?
The firm is now Alliance Bernstein. So Alliance Capital bought them out in 2000 when Sandy, who was then known as Zalman Bernstein, died.
Right. Well, I was just going to say, you might be the kiss of death. You were with Arthur Anderson.
100%.
You were with Lehman Brothers, and now Sandy Bernstein is no longer with us.
Anyway. Well, when people ask me what led me to want to start my own company, it's exactly that. I said, nobody else wanted to hire me, so.
I get it. Sorry, go ahead. I just had to.
No, I think about that often, right? They're all gone, so I started Fusion. And I wouldn't hire myself if I wasn't the CEO.
There you go. You're unhired. Probably.
So what happened was at Bernstein, they had a 6-month training program for everybody. Every new hire, most new hires, I was only 29 at the time. Most new hires, they were in their 50s and 60s. It was their third career. And what Bernstein was attracted to is these people's big Rolodex, which I didn't have. So I was an unusual hire. And what happened was in the training program, there was a day or two on behavioral finance, which is basically the science of dealing with uncertainty and money and how to make rational decisions when you're faced with both of those variables. And so it always stuck in my head. And when I went, my first 4 years of the career with Bernstein was 96 to 2000. So at the end of that 4 years, I experienced my first 50% decline in the markets with clients at a pretty young age. And again, early first real experience in my career that was challenging. So I saw, I don't know, about 50 million or 75 million of assets quickly turn into 35 million because of that. And then I was able to regroup, and we went through 2000 to 2002. 5 years later, we went down 60%. So I had just got back up to 150 million in assets, and then saw it go to 75 million. So that's what led me to behavior, right? I said there has to be a better way to run a practice and help clients than talking them off the same cliff today that I talked them off yesterday, last week, and the month before. And so I figured if we can do the lifeboat drill, as I call it, long before the bat would touch the water, we can condition them not to be overly concerned about what I call ephemera. You know, are rates going up or down 0.25% next week? Who's the president? Do I like them or not? Is this war in where whatever part of the world going to affect stocks forever? And should I get out now and wait till the quote unquote dust settles? So I learned how to deal with all of that in advance, and then on a going forward basis, keep them conditioned, you know, because of those experiences.
So how do you handle that kind of in advance? And what are some of the nuances that you have found to bubble up as the common ones in your practice? So I'll set you up with the question. Is it an asset allocation model that you use? And then you use the babysitting model after that to just make sure people stay in? Or do you preface them by saying what you think their behavior is going to be? And then when they exhibit that behavior, you do a gotcha.
Right. So it's a good question, because it gets to the heart of when you frame it in terms of asset allocation, for example. So I don't believe in asset allocation. Asset allocation in the industry sense is just for those who are listening, the how you mix your exposures to cash, bonds, and stocks. Those are the three main categories. There are other categories, but to keep it on a level that's easy for a listener to follow. And so the industry tells investors to incorporate bonds in their portfolio for one reason, generally, and that's to mute volatility or the up and down temporary movements in the numbers of dollars that they have invested.
It hasn't worked in the last couple of years.
Well, it's actually always worked. It's worked to destroy wealth. So I'll talk to you about what I mean by that, right? So yes. So now I'll get, so to answer your question, I'm going to talk about two systems of behavior, of flawed beliefs and flawed behaviors. And that's what I educate every new investor on, to help them to get to where they need to get to from a behavioral standpoint as it relates to their investment success. So the two flawed beliefs that we have, or one, if I held up a $100 bill, most people, and I say, what am I holding up in one word? They're going to say money. And so when I say we, the most successful entrepreneurs to someone who's never been in business, we don't understand the difference between money and currency.
That's right.
When I hold up a $100 bill, it's a currency unit. It's not a store of value. And if I perfectly preserve 10 million of them after I sell my business for the next 20 years, while I feel like at least I haven't lost money, I've actually lost half my money, my purchasing power, which to me is the only rational definition of money. Yep. So that mistaken belief that money and currency are the same thing causes advisors who believe it, which is most advisors, and investors who accept it, to fail, because they're told to, this is the second flawed belief, they're told to protect their money, not just from disappearing, their principal, but from fluctuating. So in other words, that's where the bonds come in. Let's put more bonds in there to protect you against what we call volatility, the number of dollars fluctuating. And by doing that, by defining risk and safety in terms of protecting principal, not just from disappearing, but from fluctuating, they're actually helping to destroy the purchasing power of every one of those dollars. Because if I put $1 million in a bond that matures in 10 years or 20, whatever it is, 20 years, at the end of the 10 or 20 years, I've still only got $1 million. But at the end of 10 or 20 years, I need anywhere between 1.3 million to 1.8 million to buy what $1 million bought. And now it's only worth either 750,000 or 500,000. So I've lost my money, but I've done it in the safest way possible because I didn't watch what to me, right? By the time I realize what they've done to me with this allocation advice, it's too late to correct it. So those are the two flawed beliefs. Money's not currency. Risk is not volatility. Risk is the chance that my last dollar leaves me before my last heartbeat. Simple. That's it. And so when you now redefine risk and safety in terms of principal, not principal protection, but purchasing power protection, we recognize that investments that lead to the freezing and diminution of my purchasing power are risky. Bonds are risky. And investments that lead to the accretion and protection of my purchasing power are safe. Stocks are safe. So that's the first thing we do, is we have to teach people that everything we're about to tell you is going to be counterintuitive and countercultural to everything you've learned. And it's what you need to accept to survive financially for the next 30 years. So that's the first
thing. I do the exact same thing, Jonathan. And I call it the myths of Wall Street. Myths like diversification, which really should be called diversification. I believe you should concentrate within an asset class, but diversify among asset classes. But you've got to be smart about it, because purchasing power is the ultimate investment measure. It's not how much money you get back, because you can get the return of your capital, but the return on your capital could be negative. And so that's what we're seeing now. Everybody is being told that we're at a 3% inflation environment, but eggs are up 200-300%. Cars are up 60-80%. Houses have doubled in the last 5 years.
That's right.
The purchasing power is not there, and it's not being preserved unless you're in assets that are just hedging inflation. If you live in a house that cost $250,000 in 2019, which was the average home, and now that house is worth $435,000, the house isn't keeping you drier than it was 5 years ago. It's not better grass. It's not a better kitchen. In fact, most of that stuff is a little bit worse. Your equipment's worn out. Your roof is wearing out.
That's right.
But at the end of the day, you think you're getting rich, but all you're doing is keeping up with the real rate of inflation. So there's so many things that we're told that are not true. So I'm glad people like you are out there educating people that that things are just not right. So you've got to learn that purchasing power thing that you talked about. Cool. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. And then the second set of flawed things that we're faced with is behavior. So I'll go through that pretty quickly with you. They're important. Yeah. So the first behavior is something that's caused by something physiological, physical, something autonomous that we have no control over. So there's something called fight or flight that most people are familiar with. Well, the fear sensor that ignites the fight or flight response is these two organs at the base of our brain called the amygdala. They're walnut-shaped things. And they were designed to protect us. So when we were roaming the African savannah millions of years ago as two hominids, because we weren't humans yet, and it was a Sunday, and since there was no football, we roamed in the African savannah because we had nothing else to do. And there's a rustle in the bush, and the first hominid says, it's just the wind. And the second hominid says, lion, and he's in the next county in 3 seconds. We're descendants of that hominid because the first guy never made it.
Okay? He didn't. Yep.
And so the amygdala that developed over these years to save us from life and death threats so we can survive, don't distinguish between life and death threats and the Dow going down 30%. Dow goes down 30%. Amygdala says, sell. Get out of the way of danger. The opposite of what we should do. So that's the first flawed behavior. The second I call a cultural behavior. So we pretty much are attracted economically to prices when they go down, to goods and services when the price is on sale. And we're repelled by things generally when the price is increasing. And we behave in that way, which is called counter-cyclical. Our demand is counter to the price movement. Demand goes up when price goes down and vice versa. We behave that way with every financial and economic input except the price of stocks. Price of stocks is high and rising. We want to buy more and more of it, thinking the risk of paying higher prices is now lower than it used to be. And my claim on the future earnings of these companies paying a higher price somehow will give me a better result. And vice versa, on the way down, we think the declining temporary price is also indicative that the future opportunity in the business has gone away, and that I'm taking on more risk by paying lower prices for the future earnings and the asset growth of these companies. And what I tell people is reality is not different than what human nature thinks. It's the opposite. So again, you've got to teach people to undo the baggage that they've got. And the third thing is psychological. The third behavior is psychological. So the biggest psychological impact is loss aversion bias. So we actually feel the pain of a loss 2 times greater than we feel the pleasure of a gain. Because of that, in investing and everything else in life, we're motivated to seek out strategies, not that maximize our wealth or return, but that minimize our chance of loss. And to make it worse, we're much more sensitive to changes in the value of what we own than to the overall value. So if someone has $10 million today in their portfolio and tomorrow it's $9,900,000, they don't think twice about it. But instead, if someone says, hey, you declined by $100,000 today, that strikes a note with them, because that change is what is very, very motivational. from a fear factor. So because we're sensitive to change, and particularly to negative change, we seek out bonds and things that are the same exact things that will minimize long-term wealth, even though they maximize short-term exposure to change in a negative way. So it's those behaviors generally, and there's a lot more of them, that we educate people about. And then we teach them, because I always believe that surprise is the mother of panic. So we teach everyone every year, if you're in the S&P 500 example, the 500 largest companies in the U.S. As an investment, it goes down about 15% every year since 1980. So you've got to be able to watch 15% of your equity money appear to disappear every year. And 1 year in five or six, a 33% decline in bear market. You have to be able to watch those things without reacting and stay on plan in spite of those things happening. If you can't, don't be an equity investor. Generally, you won't make it.
And if you can't be an equity investor, you're probably going to have a lot of trouble staying ahead of inflation.
Yeah, well, you're not even staying ahead of inflation. You're going to have a lot of trouble not running out of money.
That's right. That's right.
Hey, it's Mark Yeager here to tell you about our cash flow machine trading program that's designed to teach you how to make safe, reliable income. Now, we shoot for 2 to 4% a month of income and growth in your portfolio. And we have courses to teach you how to do this yourself or inside a mastermind community. And the best part of that is it only takes about 20 minutes a week to implement. Now, while 2 to 4% a month doesn't sound like much, I show you exactly how we took my IRA from $111,000 to over $500,000 in just 19 months without huge risk. I'm not telling you this to brag, just to show you that you could do this too. So to learn more about this program, go to cashflowmachine.io. That's cashflowmachine.io, and you can learn more.
Yeah. So you work hard for that money. You exchange your hours for money. You save the money, and then you put it in something so you don't lose the money. And then what happens is the paradox and the irony hits you, and you end up losing the money that you work so hard to gain. It's just
right.
Shame.
Using the very strategies that the industry generally tells you will protect your money.
Well, and I always say, the industry is run by two types of people: salespeople and lawyers. And the salespeople are there to gather assets, and the lawyers are there to protect the firm from getting sued. How do they protect the firm from getting sued? By putting people in average assets. So allocating things into less than average, because if you get an average return, somebody's still got to get paid to get you that average return. And so you don't get sued by going to the judge and the mediators and saying, hey,
you're 100% right. I mean, and in fact, I look at it, you know, maybe I'm saying the same thing that you're saying, but I'll tell you what we do for our clients is when you're saying average assets, what the industry will do if a 65-year-old couple comes in with $10 million, in my world, I'm going to say to them, you know, you can spend $450,000 a year. And the only role I see of bonds is to be very short term, and you should have 2 to 3 years worth of them outside of equities at retirement. So in my world, that would be like $1 million out of $10 million, or a 90% exposure to equities, stocks. In the compliance officer at Merrill Lynch or UBS or any of the big firms are going to say, oh, no, 65-year-old couple, they've got to be 30, 35, 40% in bonds. And so to the extent we have stocks, we use index funds. We use whether it's the S&P for large cap growth or the international funds, the indexes. We don't look to do anything more than try to accomplish an 8 to 10% long-term compound return. Most people don't get anywhere near that when they're chasing and doing. But the bond role is, in the traditional sense, for an investor who would follow general industry advice of, let's say, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, they would have an extra 30% of their money in bonds of $10 million in my example. That extra $3 million over 30 years of retirement at 7% a year, the average appreciation for stocks in the long run, would turn into $24 million. In the traditional industry advice, it would still be at $3 million, and that $3 million in 30 years is only worth about $1.2 million in real terms. So that's the key. The key is not to find, in our view, what the best returning thing will be for the next few years. It's what is the asset that I can achieve the best returns in for the longest period of time to stay with it. And that's how you build real wealth. But the bond piece, to your point, the function of the compliance departments is to make sure that they don't get sued successfully. That's it. Not to help the client.
That's right. Okay, so we agree on lots of stuff. Now, I got a question for you. I'm going to throw this at you. What about Bitcoin and gold?
So Bitcoin and gold is interesting. So I'll start with gold because I think they're related. And I'm, you know, I'm not against anybody taking a piece of their pie and speculating on something. Right now, Bitcoin, from my perspective, and Warren Buffett's, it's not able to be valued. It's got no real history. I don't know how to value it. It fluctuates 10% in a day or less than a week. So it can't be a medium of exchange because who's going to accept something like that? So it can't be valuable that way.
I'll accept.
You might, right. But generally, most businesses aren't going to accept something like that that fluctuates 10% a day. So broadly, I can't value it that way. But there are people who make all kinds of arguments. But I'm going to start with gold. Gold has always been presented as an inflation fighter, right? Which to me is so bizarre. It's just along the line of just crazy narratives that people don't take the time to investigate. So in 1980, the last time gold hit a bubble top because of Jimmy Carter and the inflation back then, it was 800 an ounce. Today, it's something over 2,000 an ounce. So it's gone up about 2.5 times. In 1980, the S&P 500 was 100, and today it's 5,000. It's gone up 50 times. You could have done better inflation hedging with comic books, frankly. You know, so equating, you know, the Bitcoin to me, there's not enough to know about it. But if a client wants to do it, I tell them, listen, here's what we need. If you have 10 million, we need 9 million to get 8 to 10% a year so you can retire comfortably and stay that way. Take the other million and do whatever you want with it. And if you buy Bitcoin, I hope it goes to 10 million. But if it goes, but if you come back after you take the million and you ask me for another dollar, we part ways as friends because I'm not gonna have you pay me to help you explode your wealth, right? So that's fine. So I have nothing against all that stuff, but I don't, you know, I always ask my clients or I tell them the presence or absence of Bitcoin or Japan in 1990 when that was the rage, or the BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, Indochina, when that was the rage in the 80s, or whatever it might be, or the dot-coms in the late 90s, the presence or absence of any particular thing like that in the portfolio is never going to determine your success or failure. So don't obsess with it. If you want to do some of it, God bless, do some of it. Let's leave your core intact with what has a 200-year history of always working. Let's not worry about what may or may not work. And then you don't get into trouble. So I'll leave you with one last thought. I've never had, in my whole career, I've saved many financial lives by tempering their enthusiasm for the next new thing, but I've never lost one financial life by tempering their enthusiasm for the next new thing.
That's great. That's a good place to finish out. I mean, I think there's probably a bunch more things that we can talk about, but I do appreciate that, that you're out there banging the drum about the crap that we're taught, because we're really not taught. We pick things up from Cramer and CNBC and, you know, our buddy at the bar. And that's how we learn about investing. And then, you know, even crypto, which you just mentioned, you know, people are picking that up from the shoeshine guy and the Uber driver that, you know, made a bunch of money speculating on it. And we're not really thinking about things in terms of purchasing power. So I'm glad there are people like you out there that are educating people and helping them invest as well. How can people find out a little bit more about what you do, about your firm, and how to maybe get involved with you, Jonathan?
Oh, thank you. So we are easily accessible on our website, fusionfamilywealth.com. And in the fall, at some point, we're going to have Crazy Wealthy, which is going to be our own podcast. So everybody be on the lookout for that. I'll contact you when we're out with that, and maybe you'll be one of my guests.
Let me know, man. I'll probably talk a little bit more about Bitcoin and crypto and maybe be a little controversial, but we'll have some fun with it.
No, but that's good. Look, that's my wife always says, that's why they make black and white cookies, right?
That's right. Chocolate and vanilla. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll have those linked in the show notes. And how about one final thing that you can tell people about investing? Let's gear this one for somebody that's just getting their net worth built and they're starting to look at retirement. What one thing could they do to start moving in the right direction for themselves, Jonathan?
All right. I like that question. So for the younger people or the people just starting out with savings, if somebody says to me, what's the single most important thing I could do to try and maximize my long-term wealth? I would say, start saving as much as you can, as early as you can, so that your time horizon with savings is as long as it can be. Time. So compounding is average return to the power of time. The longer my time, That's what's going to do all the heavy lifting. So start as early as you can. Don't worry about how much it is. If it's 100 a month, that's great. Just get started as early as you can so your time horizon as long as it can be for compounding.
I love it. Jonathan Blau, thank you so much for your time, your wisdom, what you're doing to help educate the world and help grow some net worths. And those of you who are listening and watching, thank you for being here. And remember what I always say, never give up your power in your health, your wealth, or your time. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Mark. Okay.
You've been listening to the Wealth Architect Podcast with Mark Yeagy. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Like and subscribe on YouTube. Share and tell your friends. See you soon.